Dylan coordinating. From 2,500 feet overhead, Dylan would have radio contact with 3rd Brigade Headquarters, with the battalion rear command post at Playmare, and with all the company pickup zones. He could monitor all that was said over the battalion command network. Jerry Whiteside would direct the artillery and the rocket gunships. Charlie Hastings would deal with the Air Force fire support, and Mickey Parrish would deal with Bruce Crandall and the helicopter people. Third, I had to maximize the impact of the 80 men who would be on the ground alone during the first critical half hour. Standard operating procedure in the new science of airmobile warfare dictated that the lead elements scatter out over 360 degrees and secure the entire perimeter. Not this time. I had been thinking about a new technique that seemed tailor-made for the situation. Bravo Company would assemble in a central location in the landing zone as a reserve and strike force. 4 7-man squads would be sent out in different directions to check out the perimeter and surrounding area. If one of those squads encountered enemy forces, I could then shift the rest of the company in that direction and carry the fight to the enemy well off the landing zone. Around 10:30 p.m., Plumlee and I walked back to the operations tent to check on preparations. Everything was going fine. Plumlee suggested we get some sleep, saying it might be a long while before we got another chance. We walked back to where we had left our packs, got out our ponchos, rolled up in them on the ground, weapons close at hand, and went to sleep. Chapter 4. The Land and the Enemy. He who controls the Central Highlands controls South Vietnam. Vietnamese military maxim. The Central Highlands is a beautiful region. From the heavily populated coastal areas with their white sandy beaches and flat rice paddies bounded by dikes, it climbs into the rougher stream-cut foothills and finally on into the 2,000 to 3,000-foot high mountains of the interior, where the French built their coffee and tea plantations. In 1965, the highlands were the domain of the Green Berets, the U.S. Special Forces. But before the military men and before the French, this was the homeland of the many different tribes of Montagnards, or mountain people, each tribe with its own dialect and territory, living a life little changed since the Bronze Age, when they were driven out of southern China to settle the mountain ranges of Indochina, the Malay Archipelago, and even some of the Indonesian lands. They practiced slash-and-burn agriculture, creating small clearings in the thick jungle, tilling and cultivating corn and cassava and yams in the thin mountain soil until in 3 or 4 years it was exhausted and then moving on. The Montagnards lived communally in thatch-roofed longhouses built on stilts. They had always steered clear of the lowland Vietnamese, who called them savages and treated them with contempt and harshness. The hatred was returned in kind, and the Montagnards willingly soldiered against the Vietnamese, first for the French and then for the Americans. They were brave, loyal, and deadly mercenaries who were highly effective soldiers in their home territory. The principal communications and supply route across the highlands is the fabled Colonial Route 19, which runs from the port of Quy Nhon west to Pleiku, the capital of the highlands, and on into Cambodia. The 1st Cavalry Division base camp at An Khe was halfway between Quy Nhon and Pleiku, about 40 miles from each of those key cities. Shortly after we arrived in Vietnam, Sergeant Major Plumlee and I took a jeep and a shotgun guard and drove 10 miles west of An Khe on Route 19, into no man's land, to the PK-15 marker post. There the Viet Minh had destroyed most of the French Group Mobile 100 in a deadly ambush 11 years earlier. We walked the battleground where a bullet-pocked 6-foot-high stone obelisk declares in French and Vietnamese, "Here on June 24, 1954, soldiers of France and Vietnam died for their countries." In my hand was Bernard Fall's Street Without Joy, which describes the battle. Plumlee and I walked the battleground for 2 hours. Bone fragments, parts of weapons and vehicles, web gear and shell fragments and casings still littered the ground. From that visit, I took away one lesson. Death is the price you pay for underestimating this tenacious enemy. North of Route 19 and west of the spectacular Manyang Pass, the land is hilly and mountainous, with some primary jungle and occasional broad plateaus. The few secondary roads are unpaved and impassable in the monsoon season. In the Laos-Cambodia-South Vietnam tri-border region, there are dense triple-canopy rainforests where the sun never penetrates, the soil is always wet, and tangles of wait-a-minute vines wait for the walker. South of Pleiku and Route 19, north of Ban Me Tuot, and west of the Plei Me Special Forces Camp, is scrub jungle with stunted hardwood, crisscrossed only by rushing mountain streams, animal trails, and montagnard paths. The dominant terrain feature is the Chu Phong Massif, rising to just over 2,400 feet, a jumble of mountains, valleys, ravines, and ridges that runs westward for more than 15 miles, the last five of them inside Cambodia. North to south, the massif measures between 10 and 13 miles. The limestone heights of the Chu Phong are full of springs, streams, and caves. Along the massif's north side runs the Ia Drang. Ia means river in one of the highlands dialects. The Ia Drang is born of the marriage of two smaller streams near the Kateka Tea Plantation on Colonial Route 14 between Pleiku and Plei Me Camp. By the time it reaches the Chu Phong area, it is swift and deep, and during the monsoon, it is a raging torrent. It flows to the west, on into Cambodia, where eventually it empties into the Mekong River and returns to Vietnam far south in the delta. The soldiers commanded by Brigadier General Chu Huy Man had been training for more than 18 months. When they joined the People's Army, each recruit was issued two khaki shirts, two pairs of khaki trousers, a sewing kit, and a pair of Ho Chi Minh sandals cut from used truck tires. Those uniforms were expected to last for 5 years. Basic training lasted 13 weeks, 6 days a week, 6 a.m. to 9:15 p.m. The instructors emphasized weapons and tactics, the hows of warfare, while the political commissars had time set aside each day to lecture on the whys of this war. The recruits were reminded constantly that their fathers had beaten the French colonialists. Now it was their duty to defeat the American imperialists. They were imbued with Ho Chi Minh's dictum, "Nothing is more precious than freedom and independence." After basic training, some were selected for 6 months of NCO school and would emerge as new corporals. For the rest, advanced infantry training included familiarization with all weapons, the use of explosives, ambush tactics, reconnaissance tactics, adjusting mortar fire, and patrol tactics. In June of 1964, Man soldiers moved up into the mountains of North Vietnam, terrain similar to that in the western highlands of South Vietnam. Here, physical conditioning was emphasized. They scaled steep slopes while wearing rucksacks loaded with 50 to 60 pounds of rocks. Their advanced training now also focused on the art of camouflage. They got rudimentary instruction in anti-aircraft defenses. Fire on full automatic straight in front of the aircraft's line of flight so that the helicopter or airplane will fly into a wall of bullets. When the time came for them to begin the arduous 2-month journey down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos, General Man's regiments broke down into battalions for security purposes, each moving separately and at least 3 days ahead of the next. Each soldier carried 4 pounds of rice, 7 days' rations, plus another 8 pounds of foodstuffs that were expected to last him the whole trip. 2 pounds of salt, 2 pounds of wheat flour, and 4 pounds of salt pork. One man in every squad carried the aluminum cookpot that the squad's rice would be boiled in. Each man also carried 15 anti-malaria pills, one for each day on the trail, and 100 vitamin B1 tabs to be taken at the rate of 3 per week. Despite the pills, virtually every man who walked the trail contracted malaria, and on average, 3 or 4 soldiers of each 160-man company would die on the journey. Malaria, diarrhea, accidents, poisonous snakes, and American air raids all took their toll. Along the route, the men passed construction crews. Many of the workers were young girls who were employed by the thousands in improving the network of trails and the campsites that were situated every 9 miles along the route. Each camp, which could shelter a company of troops, consisted of a series of crude bamboo huts dispersed along a half mile of trail to make a smaller target for the warplanes. Each man carried a light canvas hammock to string up in the huts at night. Each also carried a long rectangular piece of green plastic for a makeshift poncho. The nights on the trail were cold, the days comfortable. Man soldiers marched 9 miles each day, the distance between the rest camps where they spent each night. Every fourth day they stayed in camp, taking the day off to rest up, wash their clothes, and tend to minor medical problems. Porters pushed bicycles, modified with one long pole tied to the frame and rising 3 feet above the saddle, and another long steering pole tied to the left handlebar. Bundles containing more than 350 pounds of rice or ammunition or medical supplies were strapped and tied to the bicycle frame and the tall pole. The porter walked alongside and pushed the load, steering the contraption with the pole tied to the handlebar. No tech, primitive, ridiculously simple, yes, but it delivered the goods. Pack horses also worked the trail. Besides his food and medicine, each soldier carried his weapon and a basic load of ammunition. The weapons were those the men had trained with all those months on the firing ranges, a jumble of East Bloc surplus from the factories of the Soviet Union, China, Czechoslovakia, and Albania. Among them were the Kalashnikov AK-47 assault rifle, a superb infantry weapon, the SKS Semenov semi-automatic carbine with folding bayonet, the Degtyarev automatic rifle, the Maxim heavy machine gun, 60mm, 82mm, and 120mm mortars, the 12.7mm anti-aircraft machine gun, the wooden-handled potato masher-type hand grenade, and a Chinese-made 9mm automatic pistol for the officers. People's Army soldiers, young and old, were inveterate diarists. Almost every man carried a small notebook, which he filled with copied love poems, the lyrics of popular songs, and his own writings. The men yearned for home and family. The notebook and two or three small snapshots of a sweetheart or wife and children were carried wrapped inside plastic. Now, in late September, as the American cavalrymen were hacking their new base camp out of the jungle near Ankei, one of General Mann's regiments, the 320th, was already in South Vietnam. The second, the 33rd, had just reached the Cambodian-South Vietnamese border, and a third, the 66th, still had battalions strung out along the trail. The terrain where they would operate for the next 2 months from Playmay Camp west to the Cambodian border is largely a rolling savanna of 4 to 5 foot high elephant grass wooded with scrub trees, not unlike the American scrub oak, and some other varieties that are taller and thicker, especially along the creek and stream beds. There are no roads, and only a few trails in the interior of this region. The land is drained from northeast to southwest by two small rivers, the Iamur on the west and the Iataye to the east. Although the topographical maps we carried were sprinkled with 20 or so black dots marking Montagnard villages, we saw no villages or Montagnards out there. The Vietnamese People's Army historian Major General Hoang Phuong, who as lieutenant colonel was sent to the Ia Drang Valley in the fall of 1965 to study the battles and write an after-action report for the high command, says, "When we received the news that the 1st Air Cavalry had come to Vietnam, the commanders of our divisions in the south were very nervous, very worried by what they were hearing about this strong mobile unit so well equipped with helicopters. The liberation forces, moved mainly by foot, were poorly equipped. Our hospital and food services were not so good. How can we fight and win against the cavalry?" Major General Phuong adds, "In September of 1965, when you landed at Ankei, our commanders in the Central Highlands studied how to cope. We foresaw that the coming battle would be very fierce. First, We evacuated the population and prepared training camps. We improved our positions, dug shelters, and prepared caches of food and underground hospitals. We knew that sooner or later you would attack our zones, and we tried to prepare positions that would neutralize you. We knew that it would not be enough just to make propaganda saying that we were winning. We had to study how to fight the Americans. Fuong continues, On October 19th, we started our attack on Plein Mé at 11:50 p.m. We attacked from three directions. This was the 33rd Regiment. They had rehearsed the attack. When we encircled Plein Mé, the ARVN sent one regiment as a relief force. On October 23rd at 1 p.m., the first reinforcements reached our ambush position. Our 320th Regiment had set up the ambush. The battle took place along 4 kilometers of Provincial Route 5. The enemy made many airstrikes, bombing our positions fiercely. The fighting continued until October 25th. We destroyed the first group of Saigon forces, but other ARVN occupied the high ground and kept fighting. We could not destroy the entire relief column. There were too many of them who survived. Our 320th Regiment suffered heavy losses to airstrikes, and at 5 p.m., October 25th, we ordered the withdrawal of our troops from the battle area, including the forces surrounding Plein Mé. They were ordered to withdraw rapidly and be prepared to fight against Americans. That was the end of Phase 1 of the campaign. The two regiments involved in this battle were recently arrived from the north, and they did not have much knowledge of this area. The commanders of these two regiments were also new. During the French War, they had been company commanders. The commander of the 320th Regiment was Major Ma Van Min. The commander of the 66th Regiment was Lieutenant Colonel Lan Nhoc Chau. On October 28th, the Americans dropped some troops in the rear of our base. At that time, the headquarters of General Chu Huy Man, B3 Front, was at Plei Bon Klo. We opened Phase 2 of the campaign from October 29th to November 9th. At that time, our troops were in great disorder. We had many difficulties. You dropped troops close to our headquarters and very close to our units. Our units were broken up, dispersed, and then the Americans dropped into Plei Te, near the Cambodian border on November 3rd. You destroyed many caches and supplies of food, as well as our hospital. We lost weapons, war material, supplies, and our communications. When we withdrew, you dropped troops to cut off our units. We lost communications with the retreating units. During these 10 days, you caused much distress and disorder. Our soldiers did not have time to rest and regroup. When we withdrew to our base here, Chupong, we had to send soldiers far away to carry rice and foodstuffs back for their units. Normally it took 1 day to go there, 1 day to come back, 2 days round trip. We lacked communications equipment. We had very few radios, and those we had were in very bad condition. Your attacks were very effective. We tried to take advantage of the terrain and avoid contact and casualties. General Mann's headquarters were now in Plei Te. He had moved close to the border, to the south of Chupong. Lieutenant General Wang Huan, now commandant of the Vietnamese Army's Senior Military Academy, was a senior lieutenant colonel and the deputy commander of the B-3 front in the fall of 1965. From an advance command post near the ambush site, he directed the failed ambush against the South Vietnamese relief force bound for Plei Mé camp. During the withdrawal, he had pulled his command post back to a position on the slopes of the Chupong Massif. For decades, the senior commanders of the North Vietnamese Army have been shadowy, mysterious figures who often fought under nom de guerre. Not much was known of their background and history. Even the secret files of the Central Intelligence Agency and Defense Intelligence Agency held little information. An's biography is that of a soldier with more than 45 years on active duty, much of it spent in the field in Vietnam's two great wars. I was born in 1926 in Hanoi. My father was a technician at Bach Mai Airport. He was involved in the anti-French movement since 1937 and was put into prison by the French in 1939. So I got this infection from my father, and it was a passion for me from a young age. When our Autumn Revolution succeeded in 1945, I joined the army. My first tour was as an enlisted soldier. After that, I was assigned to a school training squad leaders. I also applied for political school and became a company commissar. But I asked to change my job back to military commander. So I had been through all levels in the army. Corporal, sergeant, company commander, battalion commander. I became deputy commander and then commander of a regiment in Dien Bien Phu. My regiment fought on the French strong point, Elian One, right on top of the shelter of the French commander, General Christian de la Croix du Castries. When the French war was over, I became a staff officer, then a division commander. I commanded four different divisions, the 35th Division, the 1st Division, and the 308th Division, a very famous division with a proud history. I took my current position as commandant of the Senior Military Academy 4 years ago. Before that, I commanded the Military Academy, which trains regimental commanders. I have 3 children. My daughter is a major and she is married to a major. My second son is an engineer. My other son is a marine construction designer. I have 3 grandchildren, all girls. My wife was a teacher of chemistry and is now retired. Of the Ia Drang campaign, Anne says, when we attacked Playmare Camp in Phase 1, we encircled the position in order to destroy the reinforcements. Our purpose was to draw the Saigon ARVN column into coming out to reinforce. We had a strong force, but no intention of liberating territory. We wanted to destroy enemy forces. As we launched this campaign, we learned that American troops had landed in Vietnam. We believe that in Phase 1, if we attack Playmare, the ARVN will come and we will ambush their reinforcements. In Phase 2, we believe that the Americans would come and we would attack them. We had learned that the Americans could drop troops far behind us, so in Phase 3, we would be ready to attack Americans in our rear areas. We sent an advance command post to be near the ambush, staffed by myself, Deputy B3 Commander, and Lieutenant Colonel Duc Vu Hiep, Deputy Political Commissar of B3 Front, who was now also a Lieutenant General. We had a very small group escorting us, maybe 40 people total. Some intelligence officers and operations officers on staff. It was a very small, very mobile command group. Senior General Chu Huy Man, former Chief Political Commissar of the People's Army, and until recently, a member of the Communist Party Central Committee, is now near 80 years of age. He retired from the Army only in 1990. His rank of Senior General, the highest in the Vietnamese Army, is equivalent to the rank of 5-star General in the American Army. Only 5 men, including Vo Nguyen Giap, have ever achieved it. Man's personal story. I joined the revolutionary movement in 1930, just after the Indochina Communist Party was formed. I was imprisoned in Con Tum by the French. In 1945, during the Autumn Revolution, I joined the army and became a regimental commander. I commanded a number of regiments and was involved in most of the campaigns of the French War. During Dien Bien Phu, I was political commissar of the 316th Division Column. General Nguyen Hu An was one of my regimental commanders in the Dien Bien Phu attack. I moved to South Vietnam in 1964. I was first stationed in the Delta of Central Vietnam, then moved to the Central Highlands in 1965. General Man says the arrival of the first American combat troops in South Vietnam, especially the 1st Cavalry Division, forced a major change in plans for the fall-winter offensive as early as June of 1965. We used our new plan to lure the tiger out of the mountain. First, we attack Playmare. Then the ARVN reinforcements come into our ambush. Then, I was confident, the Americans will use their helicopters to land in our rear, land in the Ia Drang area. It was our intention to draw the Americans out of An He. did not have any plans to liberate the land, only to destroy troops. Mann says he employed 5 battalions in Phase 1. 1 reinforced battalion to besiege Playmare Camp and 4 to prepare the Route 5 ambush, while a 6th battalion remained in reserve. "We didn't have enough troops," Mann says, explaining the failure of the ambush. The personality of the campaign changed drastically as the North Vietnamese broke off their attack on Playmare and abandoned the ambush attempt. General Mann ordered his 320th and 33rd regiments back to the Chu Phong base camp area to rest and regroup. The 320th reached a position along the Cambodian border, south of Chu Phong, practically untouched, but the hard luck 33rd regiment, which had suffered heavy casualties and was battle-weary, would endure additional blows on its retreat west, harassed relentlessly by the air cavalry troops of the 1st Brigade. Captured documents and prisoner interrogations revealed that by the time it reached the Chu Phong base area, the 33rd PAVN Regiment was reporting that some 40% of its officers and men, including 2 of the 3 battalion commanders, had been killed. The 33rd had lost virtually all of its 18 12.7mm anti-aircraft machine guns and 11 mortars, and the 1st Battalion 33rd Regiment, which conducted the siege of Playmare, was down to only 1 company of effectives. General An says that the 33rd Regiment was given some replacements and built back to a strength of about 900 when it reached the base camp. But the general's hopes and plans now revolved around the newly arrived 66th Regiment, which had had no part in the Playmare attacks. General Mann's 3 regiments regrouped in the Ia Drang Chu Phong base area. The region had been a Viet Minh sanctuary during the long war with the French. The Viet Minh successors, the Viet Cong, had made limited use of the Ia Drang as a hiding place during the years since 1954. General Mann could think of no more ideal place for his secret base and staging area for the 1965-1966 campaign. It had ample water for cooking, cleaning, drinking, and caring for casualties. It had deep wooded defiles and jungle-covered valleys for basing troops, locating hospitals, and storing supplies. Under the jungle canopy were excellent training areas and wide trails on which troops could move, even during the day, without being detected from the air. Best of all, the Ia Drang Valley was convenient to the inviolable sanctuary across the Cambodian border. The North Vietnamese porters had hauled, on their sturdy bicycles and pack horses, huge quantities of rice, peanuts, and salt, as well as big cans of cooking oil, to stockpile for the troops. Others brought in tons of ammunition, weapons, EE-8 field phones, and WD-30 communication wire. One huge North Vietnamese supply depot was spread over a square mile across the Ia Drang, less than 3 miles north of a large clearing at the base of the Chu Phong Massif. The 66th Regiment of the B-3 Front was composed of the 7th, 8th, and 9th Battalions, each at or near its full strength of 40 officers and 515 enlisted men. Still on the trail and scheduled to arrive in mid-November was a battalion of 120mm mortars and a battalion of badly needed anti-aircraft guns. General Mann could also call on the local veterans of the H-15 Main Force Viet Cong Battalion, 600 strong, for duty as porters, guides, and fighters. October and early November had not been the best of times for General Mann. If the old plan to take Pleiku and attack down Route 19 to the coast had indeed been abandoned by Hanoi, and a new one substituted whose focus was to learn how to fight the new American combat troops, the lesson was proving very costly. The game of foxes and hounds, as played by John B. Stockton's 1st Squadron of the 9th Cavalry, had been won hands down by the hounds. But General Mann was about to get what he says he wanted: decisive engagement with a battalion of American cavalry soldiers right in his own backyard. And where were the enemy when the 1st Battalion 7th Cavalry came calling? Uncomfortably close. According to Mann, An and Phuong, most of the 33rd Regiment was dispersed in a 2-mile line along the eastern face of the Chu Phong. The 9th Battalion, 66th Regiment, was 500 yards south and west of a large clearing near the base of the mountain. The 7th Battalion, 66th Regiment, was on the ridgeline above that clearing, not more than 90 minutes marching time away. The 8th Battalion, 66th Regiment, was half a day's march to the northeast across the Ia Drang. The H-15 Viet Cong Battalion was perhaps 8 hours distant. The 320th Regiment was over on the Cambodian border, 10 miles northwest. General An says, "When you landed here, you landed right in the middle of three of our battalions of the 66th Regiment, our reserve force. It was the strongest we had. At full strength, the battalions each had about 450 men. Also, there was a headquarters battalion. The regiment's total strength was about 1,600 men." When it came time to give a code name for map and radio identification to that clearing we finally chose for our landing at the base of Chu Phong, Captain Dillon, my operations officer, did the honors. He normally picked short words, the names of animals or birds, one-digit numbers, the letters of the alphabet as expressed by the NATO phonetic system. That day, he went with the letter X, or X-ray in the NATO alphabet. The North Vietnamese in 1965 also used code letters to shield the identities of their regiments. General An says the code letter for the 66th Regiment at that time was X. Thus was the stage set. X-ray. Chapter 5. Into the Valley. The great joy of the cavalry was to be so far away, out in the clean air, the open spaces, away from those damned councils. Buford felt the beautiful absence of a commander, a silence above him, a windy freedom. Michael Shara, The Killer Angels. Sergeant Major Plumley and I rolled out of our ponchos at the old French fort outside the barbed wire at Playmay's Special Forces Camp. It was 4:30 on Sunday morning, November 14th, and the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry had work to do today. We walked back to the operations tent, which was manned around the clock. No change in our orders had come through overnight. But over a cup of coffee, Matt Dillon passed along one interesting piece of information that the radio relay intercept team attached to our headquarters had come up with. Says Dillon, they had made an intercept of a coded message in Mandarin dialect, like a situation report, from a position somewhere on a line from Playmay Camp directly through a clearing at the base of Chu Phong Mountain. The intelligence lieutenant had a map with a line drawn on it. He said that the radio transmitter was somewhere on this line. I don't remember how long that message was. That didn't really bother me. It was the direction it came from. The lieutenant said he thought that possibly there was a North Vietnamese regiment somewhere out there near Chu Phong Mountain. Plumley and I shaved, breakfasted on sea rations, and drank some black coffee. Then I got my pack and ammunition ready and cleaned my M16 rifle and .45 caliber pistol. As day broke that morning, it was cool and fresh at Playmay, with patches of wispy ground fog. This was the middle of the dry season, and the sun just peeking over the horizon promised that the day would be a hot one. John Heron and his Bravo Company troops were flying in from brigade headquarters in Chinook helicopters. I walked out to the dirt strip to meet him and brief the air reconnaissance party. The same Chinooks that brought in Bravo Company then picked up the big guns of Alpha Battery, 1st Battalion, 21st Artillery to move them out to Landing Zone Falcon where they would support our air assault deeper into the valley. Heron's men moved off to relax in the brush south of the airstrip. They had time to eat, refill their canteens, and check and clean their weapons. Unfortunately, they were not as fresh as they should have been. Brigade headquarters had kept them on 100% alert all night. I walked over to Bruce Crandall's Huey and quickly briefed those who would accompany us on the recon flight over the Ia Drang Valley. Colonel Tim Brown had told us generally where he wanted us to operate after the landing, but we now had to select a landing zone and preferably one that would take as many of our 16 Hueys as possible at one time. All of us would have preferred not to make an air recon flight at all. We didn't want to spook the enemy in the area and possibly alert them to an imminent landing. But we could not choose a landing zone for this assault simply by looking at a 1 to 50,000 map. We had to overfly the area. We would minimize the chances of discovery by flying high around 4,500 feet and pass well to the southeast of the Chu Pang Massif on a straight-line flight to the vicinity of Duc Co Special Forces Camp. After orbiting the camp for 5 minutes, we would fly a slightly different return route. Our hope was that any enemy commander in the area would reckon that the two lift ships and the two gunships were on other business in other areas. With binoculars, we would be scanning for the right clearing, one with few obstacles and plenty of space. The flight went precisely as planned. We took no anti-aircraft fire and saw no enemy activity. On our return to Playmate Camp, we quickly settled on three possible landing zones, X-Ray, Tango, and Yankee. Major Henri Pete Mallet, the 3rd Brigade Operations Officer, flew in with a half-page frag from Colonel Brown. One of our landing zone options, Yankee, was about 1 mile south of the designated area of operations. It was on sloping ground but could take only 6 or 8 Hueys. A possibility. Tango was in the middle of the valley and closer to the Ia Drang by a mile or so, which was good. But it was too small. It could handle only 2 or 3 Hueys at once, and worse yet, it was almost a well encircled by very tall trees. The pilots hated wells. To land, they had to slow almost to a hover, then drop into the well. Hovering helicopters are juicy targets. We crossed off Tango. That left X-Ray. It was flat. The trees around it weren't all that tall, and it looked as though it could take up to 8 helicopters at one time. I told the command group that I had tentatively decided on the clearing called X-Ray, but wanted some more information. Turning to Captain Ricard, the 1st Squadron 9th Cavalry Scout Section Leader, I asked him to take his tiny 2-man 813 observation helicopters on a fast nap-of-the-earth flight through the target area to pick up more details on X-Ray, Yankee, and the surrounding area. By now, all the company commanders had assembled at the battalion command post. While we waited for the scout helicopters to return with their reports, I again urged the company commanders to make certain every rifleman had at least a basic load of 300 rounds of ammo and 2 hand grenades, plus as much additional ammunition as he felt he could carry. Each of the M79 grenadiers should have at least 36 of the fat little 40mm rounds. Each squad should be carrying 2 of the new LAW light anti-tank weapon rockets for bunker busting and taking out machine gun crews. And I reminded the commanders of follow-on units waiting for their turn to ride into the landing zone to stay tuned to the command net and listen to what was going on so they wouldn't be in the dark about the situation at X-Ray when they finally got there. Now the scout pilots returned and reported. Landing zone Yankee could be used, the scout pilots reported, but it would be risky because it was covered with old tree stumps. X-Ray definitely could take 8 to 10 Hueys at a time. Finally, they said they had spotted Kamo wire, a phone line, running east to west on a trail north of X-Ray. That tipped the balance in favor of X-Ray because it offered certain evidence that there were enemy soldiers in the immediate area. X-Ray would be the assault landing zone, with Tango and Yankee as alternates. At 8:50 a.m. on the west end of the Playmate Strip, I issued orders to the assembled company commanders, liaison officers, pilots, and staff. Assault into LZ X-Ray to search for and destroy the enemy. Bravo Company lands first, accompanied by my command group. Then Alpha, then Charlie, and then Delta companies. Bravo and Alpha will move northwest on my order. Charlie Company will move southwest toward the mountain, likewise on my order. Delta Company will control all mortars. The recon and machine gun platoons will be battalion reserve. Artillery will fire 8 minutes each on Yankee and Tango for deception, then a 20-minute preparatory fire on X-Ray and adjacent areas. 30 seconds of aerial rocket artillery and 30 seconds of helicopter gunship prep fire would follow. The battalion rear command post, run by my executive officer, Major Herman Wirth, and our supply point and medical aid station would both shift forward to Landing Zone Falcon, where the two artillery batteries were located. Colonel Brown arrived, and I walked him through the plan. He agreed with everything, including the selection of X-ray as the assault landing zone. He chatted with one of the officers and troopers for a few minutes. Then, just before he left, he did something out of the ordinary. Says Matt Dillon, "Colonel Brown called Moore and me aside. He told us, 'I want you two to be especially careful on this operation.' He looked concerned. As we walked Brown to his helicopter, he repeated his instructions. 'Stay tight, and don't let your companies get separated.' At 9:15 a.m., the two artillery batteries reported they were going into position and would soon be ready to fire. I set 10:30 a.m. as touchdown time. Commanders returned to their companies, the staff to the command post. The Huey air crews were being briefed by their pilots. Then we got word that because of air movement delays, the artillery was not yet in position in LZ Falcon and could not begin the prep fires on the Iadrang targets before 10:17 a.m. H hour slid back accordingly, and the word was passed down the line. Dillon lifted off in the battalion command helicopter with the fire support and helicopter coordination group. Bruce Crandall and I stood beside his chopper discussing final details. The precise flying time from liftoff at Playmate to touchdown at X-ray came up. Crandall's co-pilot, Captain John Mills, a 25-year-old native of the Panama Canal Zone, worked for a couple of minutes over his maps, flight table, and calculator, looked up and said, 13 minutes, 15 seconds. I bet him a beer he couldn't hit it dead on the nose. He took me up on that bet. He kept an honest log and collected his beer three nights later at Camp Holloway near Pleiku. We loaded aboard, and Crandall and Mills pre-flighted the Huey. Then Crandall fired up both his engine and a big fat cigar. We were enveloped in a choking cloud of red dust as all 16 Hueys strained toward liftoff. Crandall, in the left seat, looked back. I gave him a thumbs up and pointed westward. He pulled pitch and lifted off, and we were bound for Landing Zone X-ray. We flew over a broad, slightly rolling plain dotted with trees 30 to 50 feet tall, interspersed with a few old Montagnard farm clearings, small winding streams, and dry stream beds. We saw no villages and no people. It was Sunday morning, but I didn't realize that. Over here we paid attention to the date, not the day. In the field in Vietnam, all days were the same, hot and wet or hot and dry, but always dangerous. Back in Columbus, Georgia, it was Saturday night. My wife had put our five kids to bed and was watching the nightly news on television. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara announced plans to abolish 751 Army Reserve units, including six reserve divisions. The Yarmouth Castle cruise ship burned and sank at sea, and 91 passengers were missing. The New York Times headlined a James Reston think piece, "Washington, War on the Installment Plan." Joe Namath, who had been paid an unthinkable $400,000 bonus for signing with the New York Jets, was having a great first season in pro football. The troop doors on the Huey helicopters were open. We flew at 2,000 feet to reduce the chances of being hit by enemy small arms fire as we traversed 14.3 miles of hostile country. We flew in four groups of four helicopters each, with each group in a heavy left formation, and Crandall's four helicopter gunships guarding our flanks, two on each side slightly forward of us. Captain John Herron, whose Bravo Company troops filled the helicopters, recalls, "It was a misty, cool morning with some low-hanging fog when we lifted off, but shortly after takeoff we broke into the clear, and you could see the 105mm artillery pounding the areas around the LZ as we headed in." Vietnam, even in war, was scenic, with the green jungle, heavy forested mountains, and wild-looking rivers crisscrossing the terrain. About 4 miles from X-ray, Bruce Crandall gave the signal and his pilots dropped down to treetop level to fly nap of the earth on the final approach. Birds scattered as we roared along at 110 miles per hour just above their perches. High overhead in the command chopper, Matt Dillon was running the fire support preparations. The hairiest part of any operation was always the air assault. We had to time the flight and the artillery so close. When the choppers were 1 minute out, the last artillery rounds had to be on the way, or you get Huey's landing with the shells. We always sweated because if you shut down the artillery too soon, the enemy could be up and waiting when the choppers came in. This one was precisely on time. We were 2 minutes out now and could see smoke and dust flying around the landing zone. Minimum fire had been directed on the clearing. If there were enemy, they wouldn't be there, but it concealed positions around the clearing's edge. Now the helicopters of the aerial rocket artillery slammed that perimeter with rockets, grenades, and machine gun fire, using 24 of the 48 2.75-inch rockets each carried. They saved the other half in case we needed help after we got on the ground. As the ARA ships banked steeply away to take up an orbit nearby, the four escorting gunships left us and dashed ahead to take over the firing that would keep any enemy heads down on our final approach. Major Bruce Crandall recalls, "We went low level and arrived right on schedule at the release point into the landing zone. The landing zone was not as clear of obstacles as we would have liked, but we got our flight in without any real problems. The only movement we spotted in the landing zone was something that looked like a dog scampering into some underbrush on the far side. It was probably an enemy soldier. Now the door gunners on the lift ships were firing into the tree line as we dropped into the clearing. I unhooked my seatbelt, switched the selector switch on my M16 to full automatic, rock and roll, and fired bursts into the brush to the left, toward the mountain, as Crandall came in hot and flared over the dry, 5-foot-tall elephant grass. As the chopper skids touched the ground, I yelled, "Let's go," and jumped out, running for the trees on the western edge of the clearing, firing my rifle. It was 10:48 a.m. Sergeant Major Plumley, Captain Metzger, Bob Ouellette, and Mr. Nick, the translator, were right behind me. Heron and his men came out of their Hueys in like fashion. In less than 10 seconds, Crandall's first lift of 8 ships had roared back into the air, banked north, and hightailed it back east. The second wave of 8 helicopters was now touching down to disgorge its troops. I ran across 25 yards of open ground, then across a waist-deep 10-foot-wide dry creek bed, and continued running some 75 yards into the scrub brush, leading the command group. We stopped to slap fresh magazines in our rifles. So far, we had been unopposed. We were in a lightly wooded area with scraggly trees 20 to 50 feet tall and dry brown elephant grass between. The area was dotted with large mounds of red dirt, most with brush and grass growing out of the tops. The size of these old termite hills ranged from that of a small automobile to that of a large pickup, and they offered excellent cover and concealment. The valley was a desolate place, with no villages and no civilians, 10 miles east of where the Ho Chi Minh Trail turned left out of Cambodia into South Vietnam. The heavily forested eastern slopes of the Chu Phong rose steep and dark, more than 1,000 feet above the clearing. The massif's lower slopes were covered with thick green foliage, elephant grass, and tangles of brush. Gullies and long fingers of ground led from the bottom of the mountain and blended into the woods and the dry creek bed where we stood. Plenty of places for people to hide. The creek bed just inside the western edge of our clearing was an excellent route of approach for enemy troops coming from the direction of the mountain or the valley, and for us going the other way. That creek bed was a critical feature. Heading back toward the clearing, we ran into some of Bravo Company's 1st Platoon troopers, led by Sergeant Larry Gilreath, moving out into the brush. Gilreath yelled, "Moore's fire team has already cleared this area." Plumley grinned. He knew that the troops liked to see the old man out with them on the ground, sharing the risks. Gilreath and his men headed deeper into the brush to the west. Plumley and I recrossed the dry creek bed and moved around the clearing, checking on the terrain and on the patrols Heron's troopers were conducting. No enemy contact so far, and I was glad of that. We didn't want to fight before we got the rest of the battalion on the ground. The clearing was about 100 yards long, east to west, and kind of funnel-shaped, with the 90-yard-wide mouth of the funnel on the western edge near that dry creek. The bottom of the funnel was on the 45-yard span of the clearing's eastern edge. In the center of the clearing was a copse of scraggly trees, about half the size of a tennis court. All told, the space at X-ray amounted to no more clear ground than a football field. Now I stopped and looked up at the steep slopes of the mountain. I had a strong sense that we were under direct enemy observation. That and the fact that everything had gone so well so far made me nervous. Nothing was wrong except that nothing was wrong. I continued reconnoitering. There were no stream beds on the north, east, or south. The southern edge of the clearing was closest to the mountain and to those draws and fingers reaching out from the high ground. The terrain to the north and east was relatively flat. My attention continued to be drawn back to the south and west. I did two things now. I ordered Heron's 1st Platoon to intensify its search to the west of the creek and check to make sure that the rest of Bravo Company was gathered in the clump of trees near the creek bed and ready for action. Heron had most of his troops on the ground. The rest were on the way in the second lift. This clearing was the only decent helicopter landing zone between the slopes of Chu Pong and the Ia Drang and for 2 miles east or west. Our assault landing had, so far as we could tell, achieved total surprise. The enemy weren't around the clearing waiting for us. But we had been seen arriving, and the North Vietnamese were already moving in our direction. The People's Army commander on the battlefield, then Senior Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Huan, says, "When you dropped troops into X-ray, I was on Chu Pong Mountain. We had a very strong position and a strong mobile command group. We were ready, had prepared for you, and expected you to come. The only question was when. The trees and brush limited our view of the helicopter's landing, but we had an observation post on top of the mountain, and they reported to us when you dropped troops and when you moved them." Sergeant Larry Gilreath's memory of this morning is clear and sharp. The 1st Platoon was told to move straight forward about 150 yards from where we landed. And from there, each squad would send two or three men out further in all directions. Sergeant John W. Mingo and the 1st Squad went forward with a couple of men and hadn't been out very long when he found a boy wandering around in the area. When Mingo brought him in, my exact words were, "Boy, hell, that ain't no boy." Mingo and his recon squad had spotted the soldier sitting on the ground. Surprised, he got up and ran. After a short zigzag chase through the brush, the sergeant tackled him and took him prisoner. Heron passed the word to me. I was pleased that the 1st Platoon had taken him alive, and not surprised when I learned that it was Mingo who caught him. Mingo was a Ranger Company veteran of the Korean War and knew the value of a live prisoner who was able to talk. It was 11:20 a.m. Just then, Crandall's 16 helicopters returned, bringing in the rest of Bravo Company and the 3rd Platoon of Alpha Company, plus Captain Tony Nadal's Alpha Company command group. They ran into the scrub brush on the northern edge of the clearing near the creek bed. Things were quiet, not happening yet, so most of the troops broke out their sea rations and ate a quick lunch. I was on my way out to question the enemy prisoner and had not yet seen Captain Nadal to give him any instructions. We had been in X-ray only 32 minutes, and the countdown was on. John Heron left the rest of Bravo Company and the cops with his executive officer, Lieutenant Ken Duncan, and joined me and my party as we rushed across the creek into the brush where Gilreath's men were holding the prisoner. He wasn't much, but he was this battalion's first prisoner in Vietnam. About 5 feet 7 inches tall, maybe 20 years old, scrawny, wild-eyed, and trembling with fear. He was unarmed and barefooted. He wore a dirty khaki shirt, partly pulled out of his khaki trousers. There was a serial number on one of the shirt epaulettes. He carried a canteen, but it was empty. He had no papers, no food, and no ammunition. When we took a prisoner on the battlefield in Korea, we never got bogged down in long interrogations. No time for that. All I wanted to know was, how many of you are there, and where are they? A look of apprehension spread over Mr. Nick's face as he shakily translated the prisoner's words. He says there are 3 battalions on the mountain who want very much to kill Americans, but have not been able to find any. What the prisoner said fit in neatly with what our intelligence people had told us, and with the big red star I had seen on the division headquarters map. I still don't know what the soldier was doing out there in the brush without food, water, or a weapon, but he was a godsend. 3 battalions of enemy added up to more than 1,600 men against the 175-plus Americans currently on the ground here. I turned to John Herron and ordered him to immediately intensify the patrols in the area where we had found the prisoner. I told Herron that as soon as enough of Tony Nadal's Alpha Company troops were on the ground to secure the landing zone, Bravo Company would be cut loose to search the lower slopes of the mountain, with special emphasis on the finger and draw to the northwest. If those enemy battalions were on the way, we needed to engage them as far off the landing zone as possible. We radioed Matt Dillon and told him to come in to pick up the prisoner and take him back to brigade for further interrogation. Dillon landed at 11:40 a.m. The forward air controller, Air Force Lieutenant Charlie Hastings, says that when Dillon put the prisoner aboard the command helicopter and relayed his words that there were many enemy in the area who wanted to kill Americans, the war suddenly had my undivided attention. Captain Nadal had been hunting for me while I was in the woods with the prisoner. We caught up with each other after the prisoner was put aboard the command helicopter. I quickly briefed Nadal on the situation and told him that Alpha Company would take over security in the LZ as soon as the next lift brought in the rest of his men. Crandall's helicopters returned at 12:10 p.m. on their third trip to X-ray, bringing in the rest of Tony Nadal's troopers minus only a few men. Now Nadal had enough men on the ground to be effective. Suddenly a few rifle shots rang out in the area where the prisoner had been captured. Sergeant Gilreath's men were in contact. It was now 12:15 p.m. We had to move fast if we were going to survive, had to get off that landing zone and hit him before he could hit us. Only if we brought the enemy to battle deep in the trees and brush would we stand even a slim chance of holding on to the clearing and getting the rest of the battalion landed. That football field-sized clearing was our lifeline and our supply line. If the enemy closed the way to the helicopters, all of us would die in this place. Even as the first shots rang out, I was radioing Herron to saddle up the rest of his Bravo Company men and move out fast toward the mountain to develop the situation. Turning to Nadal, I told him that the original plan was out the window, that his Alpha Company should immediately take over LZ security and get ready to move up on Bravo Company's left when enough of Charlie Company had arrived on the next lift to assume the job of securing the clearing. In the small cops, the other two platoons of Bravo Company men had opened sea ration cans and were grabbing a bite when they heard those first shots out in the brush. The older sergeants glanced at one another and nodded. "Eat fast," they told the men, "and get ready to move." The Battle of LZ X-Ray had just begun. Chapter 6. The Battle Begins. When first under fire and you're wishful to duck, don't look or take heed of the man that is struck. Be thankful you're living and trust to your luck, and march to your front like a soldier. Rudyard Kipling. The Young British Soldier. It was now 12:20 p.m., Bravo Company Commander John Herron radioed his 4 platoon leaders to meet him near that waist-deep stream bed that traversed the western edge of the clearing. There they would organize the assault toward the mountain. Herron talked only briefly with them. Lieutenant Al Debney of the 1st Platoon, an eager, impulsive officer who was anxious to tie into the enemy. Lieutenant Henry T. Herrick of the 2nd Platoon, an aggressive redhead who pushed his men hard and had told me he hoped he earned the Medal of Honor one day. Lieutenant Dennis Deal of the 3rd Platoon, a low-key but very effective officer, and Sergeant 1st Class Ed Montgomery, an excellent mortar man who was acting weapons platoon leader. The Bravo Company commander says, "I told Devney and Herrick to move out abreast, Herrick on the right, with Deal to follow behind Devney's platoon as reserve. The weapons platoon would support with their 181mm mortar and 40 shells." It was now near 12:30 p.m., and the Bravo Company contact was continuing to build. Specialist 4 Galen Bungham, 22, the short muscular son of a Hayfield, Minnesota dairy farmer, was in Lieutenant Herrick's platoon. He carried a 40mm grenade launcher, which looked like a short, fat, single-barrel sawed-off shotgun, and a 45 caliber pistol. Our grenadiers carried a usual load of 36 rounds for the M79. Galen Bungham this day had only 18 in his green cloth pouches. His day had started out great, had turned bad, and was about to get a lot worse. Bungham remembers, early that morning, First Sergeant Robert F. Moore